O-R-G. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, and for the next two Sundays, we present the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight, we hear In the Bible, King Josiah and His Fight Against Idolatry, the first of three lectures in the series. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Boston University President Emeritus John Silber.
This evening, I'm privileged for the 28th time to introduce Elie Wiesel on the opening of his annual series of lectures at Boston University. It was in the sixth year of my tenure as president of Boston University that we recruited Elie Wiesel. His recruitment has been a blessing to his students, his colleagues, and to me. It is here at Boston University that students may take his classes, and in the fall of each year, more than 2,400 persons from the university and from the greater Boston area are privileged to attend each of his three public lectures. His lectures are also carried to a far larger audience on Boston University's radio station, WBUR. Professor Wiesel's presence at Boston University has been notable, for his ever-growing celebrity has never altered in any way his concern for students and colleagues or their access to him. His gift of friendship is boundless. One can say without exaggeration that he is a friend of all persons of goodwill, no matter what their religious or political orientations may be. A columnist in the Boston Globe recently observed that Nobel Prizes in the sciences are typically awarded many decades after the discoveries were made for which the prize is given. This is to ensure, to the fullest extent possible, that prizes are given for work which, following hindsight and rigorous procedures of peer review, are shown to be of greatest importance. In contrast, the Nobel Prize for Peace is often given almost immediately following the achievement or merely the occasion for which it is awarded. As a consequence, the judgment of the Norwegian Nobel Committee is sometimes mocked by events. The most glaring example is the 1994 award of the Nobel Peace Prize to Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, and Yasser Arafat. As the 10th anniversary of this award approaches, the Middle East has rarely looked less peaceful, and Israel is on unremitting assaults by suicide bombers whose families are rewarded for their crimes. The Oslo Accords, for which the 1994 Peace Prize was given, are widely, and in my opinion rightly, judged to deserve much of the blame. If one did not accept the fallibility of well-meaning persons and well-meaning institutions, the Peace Prize would have been dismissed as an absurdity following its presentation to Yasser Arafat. In 1986, the Peace Prize was very different, for Elie Wiesel had for three decades been an internationally recognized witness to the Shoah, and in his efforts to promote peace, he had been an articulate opponent of hatred without regard to the individuals or groups toward whom hatred is directed. Wiesel has also been an outspoken opponent of all who are indifferent to human suffering wherever and whenever it occurs. The 1986 Peace Prize was also different because Elie did not regard the prize as the climax of his life, but merely as an incident in his continuing witness and as a means by which to leverage his witness and extend it in new directions. He has reinvested his share of Alfred Nobel's benefaction in the same cause in which he has already invested his life, and through the work of the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity, founded by Elie and his wife Marion, he has added more luster to the Nobel Award than it has brought to him. He has introduced an entirely new way for recipients of the Peace Prize to demonstrate that their prize was wisely awarded. In the years since receiving the prize, Elie, frequently in collaboration with national governments, has sponsored remarkable conferences focusing on the problem of understanding hate so that it can be countered and overcome. Most recently, on September 22nd, the government of Norway, in association with the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity, held a conference on Fighting Terrorism for Humanity, a conference on the roots of evil. It was attended by 20 heads of state or government. Because so many heads of government and state were present, the conference was limited to a single day, and the remarks of each participant were limited to 5 minutes. As could be expected, there was no coming together of minds through extended discussion that one expects in conferences organized according to Elie's typical format. Nevertheless, this conference has borne important fruit. At the close, Elie Wiesel proposed that terrorism be recognized as a crime against humanity. He is now planning, through his foundation, a 2-day conference on this subject to be attended by a variety of persons, including lawyers and judges from different countries, to examine this question in an effort to define terrorism. The definition of terrorism is an essential first step if terrorism is to be designated a crime against humanity. The conference will also have to examine the definition of crimes against humanity. Elie's proposal was supported at the conference on September 22nd by several heads of government, including those of the Netherlands, Peru, and France. These endorsements, and others sure to follow, reveal a remarkable fact about Elie Wiesel. Although he is but one private person holding no official office, he frequently finds himself in dialogue with leaders of the nations of the world. Morally, he holds a position equivalent to that of a head of state, and as such, he has the opportunity and obligation to speak truth to power in the prophetic tradition of the Hebrew prophets. In witness of his stature, Romania recently announced that Elie Wiesel will head a commission to bring to light Romania's role in the murder of thousands of Jews in World War II. This announcement was made to resolve a dispute arising from a government denial that the Holocaust ever took place in Romania. Although thousands of Jews were killed in Romania, the government denied this summer that the Holocaust ever took place there. The protests of Israel and Jewish leaders led the government to appoint as head of its inquiry Elie Wiesel, who was taken to Auschwitz from Sziget at the time in Hungary. When he was born, it was in Romania, and is now once again in Romania. The president of Romania, in placing this issue in Wiesel's hands, demonstrated his trust in Elie Wiesel's integrity and objectivity. In one of his poems, Jeffrey Hill, Elie's colleague at Boston University, wrote of a country with memorials but not memory. In arousing the government of the United States to establish the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, and in planning that memorial, Elie insisted that the memorial be a museum to ensure that memory would be inseparable from the memorial. The museum's only purpose is to present the realities of the Holocaust so that it will be remembered by increasing numbers in every succeeding generation. The Memorial Museum opened on the Mall in Washington, D.C. 10 years ago last April, on the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. It is a permanent reminder of Elie's unique influence as a witness to the Holocaust. Despite its grim contents, over 19 million persons have now visited the museum. As George Will so eloquently put it, and I quote, "The Holocaust is the black sun into which Americans especially must be taught to stare." The Holocaust Museum, a grim sermon in stone, is an experience of darkness. It is a mind-opening reminder of the furies beyond our shores, which inflict on visitors excruciating knowledge that it is intensely relevant to this era of terrorism, knowledge of the hideous possibilities of human action. End of quote. With each of the 2 million visitors annually, Eli's witness is extended. But the need for his witness never ceases. Shortly after we met last year, Eli was called to testify to a UN tribunal in The Hague on the appropriate punishment of Biljana Plavsic, a Bosnian Serb leader. Eli put this question to the panel of judges. If all the pain and suffering of all the victims were to be placed on one set of scales, how many years of prison would it take on the other to achieve justice? New calls for Eli's involvement continually arise. On October 16th, at an Islamic summit, Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad revived most of the virulent phrases of anti-Semitism, including the statement that, and again I quote, although the Europeans killed 6 million Jews out of 12 million, today the Jews rule the world by proxy. They get others to fight and die for them, end of quote. These views were not met with derision or opposition, but by a standing ovation from kings, emirs, and presidents of the member states of the Islamic Conference. Hatred is still on the march, and Eli's countermeasures are thus in ever-increasing demand. Boston University is deeply honored to be the academic home of Eli Wiesel, the moral force preeminent throughout the second half of the 20th century, and a person who continues to illumine the opening years of the 21st with his sage counsel. Tonight, Professor Wiesel will speak on In the Bible, King Josiah and His Fight Against Idolatry. The topic suggests, perhaps, that I should leave the hall at once, for I am and have been for 30 years an idolater of Eli Wiesel. Ladies and gentlemen, Eli Wiesel.
As you heard, the topic tonight is idolatry, and we intend to explore its impact on ancient sensitivities as well as our own. Though it appealed then to the primitive instincts of individuals and groups, its complexity had not vanished from contemporary history as well. What is the name of its dark magic and seductive power? Where does it draw its supernatural strength from? What are its possible blessings? And when do they become illusions? Can idolatry die in one place, in one period, and resurface in another? So tonight, let's go back to ancient times and their dramatic and often disturbing tales of conquest and defeat that to some of us may not seem totally outdated, archaic, and alien. We shall evoke royalty and its multiple challenges. In retrospect, was it considered a positive phenomenon in the tales of our peoplehood? Since royalty means power, did royalty always help move, inspire, and elevate history for the benefit of people without retreating from commitments made to the King of all kings, the King of the universe? We shall encounter a ruler tonight, a ruler whose accomplishments in national and religious domains had brought him glory and reward in our people's collective memory, but remains somehow unknown as a person, many of his aspects shrouded still in mystery. We learn a lot about David and Solomon. Much has been written about their good deeds and occasional, inevitable transgressions. You evoke their names, and everything about them sounds familiar. Not so the name of Josiah, or in Hebrew, Yoshiyahu. Were it not that it figures in a Sabbath reading of a prophetic passage following what we call the portion of the week, the Parshat HaShavua, we wouldn't even know that he existed at all. And yet, in those times, as we surely remember, things did not go too well for the people of Israel in the land of Israel, or more precisely, in both of its kingdoms. Too many new political crises, too many religious disputes, replacing old ones or just perpetuating them with ever renewed vigor. Too many divisions between those in power and those who were determined to usurp or retake it by all available means. Yes, but it was much worse. The situation could best be described by a quasi-absence of relations between our distant ancestors and the master of the universe, between the God of Israel and Israel. It was as if God had all of a sudden discovered himself an unwelcomed stranger in the land that had been sanctified by him and destined to belong to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, forgotten. Relegated, expelled, and repudiated by those whom he had liberated from Egyptian bondage and helped through numerous mortal obstacles and perils in the wilderness so as to make them into a nation of priests with whom he had concluded a covenant to last for centuries and centuries. Rarely had the people of Israel, on every level, from every viewpoint, been so separated from the God of Israel. And then, after numerous successive regimes of state-sponsored spiritual decline and all-pervasive moral corruption, sin, and idolatry, emerged the hero of our learning session tonight. He, King Josiah, made a difference. As we shall see later, crowned king in a coup d'etat at the age of 8, it was he who installed the Reformation that won him the admiration of those who remained faithful to God and lived to serve as witnesses to his bravery and loyalty. We open the book of Kings, chapter 23, and we find an amazing episode about him. When he was 18, which means 10 years in his royalty, he sent one of his men to the high priest named Hilkiyahu on a mission to collect much-needed funds, nothing is new in Jewish history, to repair the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. The campaign must have been successful. A series of happy incidents occurred, culminating in the king's solemn appeal to the nation as such to celebrate Passover. And, says the text, that event will remain in the annals of history, marked by its dimension of a sudden outburst of piety and grandeur, so much so that it will forever be remembered as Josiah's Passover. And now we are perplexed. What? Because they celebrated Passover, he was so great? Because at this point, the curious student who explores these texts fails to understand. Why does such a simple move on the part of the king, calling his people just to obey the biblical command of remembering the Exodus from Egypt, warrant such praise and such reward? Wasn't it his duty as chief magistrate and sovereign to order his subjects to behave as good Jews do and celebrate Passover as we do today, according to all rules of custom and tradition? What else could he have done? Upon rereading the episode, we discover that the text does offer an explanation, except that the explanation renders the story even more bizarre. Let us quote the brief passage as it appears in the Book of Kings. "And the king commanded all people, 'Keep the Passover to the Lord your God, as it is written in this book of the covenant. For no Passover has been kept since the days of the judges who judged Israel or the kings of Judah. But in the 18th year of King Josiah, this Passover was celebrated to the Lord in Jerusalem.'" End of quote. Now, really, is this true? Could it be? No such celebration had ever taken place. No Passover had ever been celebrated in Jerusalem between the era of the judges and the reign of Josiah, which means during the reign of Saul and Samuel, David and Solomon. And what about the prophets that succeeded Prophet Elijah? Had their voice not been heard? Is it possible that they didn't urge the ruler, "Come, hey, it's Passover, the 14th day of Nisan"? Is it possible that the story of Passover, which every generation is duty-bound to retell its children year after year in every Jewish household, is it possible it had been ignored or downgraded or relegated? Is it conceivable that David, King David, Solomon, King Solomon, had not led their people in the collective observation of remembering with joy and fervor the liberation from Pharaoh? Powerful prophetic personalities like Isaiah and Jeremiah had nothing to say about all that? Granted, the text obviously wishes to praise Josiah. But why do so at the expense of Judah's greatest and most admired kings? As always, it is incumbent upon the student to return to the written sources and scrutinize the environment, the living conditions, the visible and hidden scenery of the moment, if we wish to understand the main character of the story. Who were his spiritual guides, his counselors? Who helped him rule the turbulent country in the early youthful years of his ascendance to the throne? What made him later so audacious in his decision-making process? In general, what was like living then in Judah? How did people govern their daily activities? What was their morale, their mood, their preoccupation? Did they at least aspire to please the Lord who had chosen them to carry his message to the world? Did they try to make him proud of his creation? Were the frontiers separating good from evil clearly traced and ethical principles properly defined? In other words, in truth, could their society, rooted in a collective desire for holiness and humanity, and one not without the other, be called a moral society? Well, I'm embarrassed to admit it, but the answer to the last question is regretfully simple and sad. As hard as we may try, and we do try, we would find it hard, if not impossible, to describe that society as decent, compassionate, pious, and just. It wasn't. In fact, it was anything but just. In other words, in those times, something had gone terribly wrong in the land of our ancestors. God's dream and Moses for our people had turned into a theological nightmare. But what was Josiah's role in the story? What made him the hero of the situation? Was he great only because others were not? One cannot resist telling an anecdote that has nothing to do with the story. I'm sure most of you have heard it or even retold it. When we talk about Noah, and we talk about the village mayor or a spiritual leader who long ago in a distant country had to deliver the eulogy for the community's most despised, feared, and hated member who had just passed away. Everybody came to the funeral not to pay homage to the deceased man, but to hear their elected official and see how he would handle the situation, because normally one must utter some sad words in appreciation and praise for the person who is leaving them, who is dying or who is dead. But what good things could the mayor now possibly say about someone who cheated, lied, humiliated, and spread falsehood around him? For a while the speaker kept quiet, looking thoroughly at the audience. Then he simply said, "We have gathered here today to send off a member of our beautiful community. What can I or you say about him without perverting the truth?" He kept dramatic moment of silence. "Well, his brother was worse." Does this apply to King Josiah too? Does it mean that just as Noah was special to his generation and Samuel to his, Josiah was special to his own generation simply because the others were worse? Compared to his immediate predecessors, he was the worthiest of them all. Well, it's a good question and a good story, but at this point, following our custom established so many years ago, a preliminary statement seems in order. Let's not forget the reason for these annual study sessions, which I enjoy for several reasons. As you heard from my very dear and good friend, Dr. Silber, for 28 years I have been trying to invent new topics and original approaches for these encounters, which is not easy. But I think that Dr. Silber, who has done so much for this extraordinary institution, but I think of him that his task is equally difficult. He must invent new introductions. Well, who faces a greater challenge? At times I feel I must do something new every year just to provide my friend with a new biographical material about me. Otherwise, what would he say? I also want to thank, of course, my colleagues who are among the best that we have in the field of teaching higher education. They are all good, open, enriching, and of invaluable importance to all of us. And I want to thank my students. Every year I say it, but every year I mean it. This year, they are the best I ever had, really. I'll give you an example. Have you ever heard, really, you, my good colleagues, students who applaud each other when a student speaks? In my class, they do. And each time it happens, I feel so proud. They don't applaud me. They applaud each other. And, of course, lastly, a remark. These study sessions, of course, compel me to invest even greater energy in learning together with my colleagues and my gifted students. Learning has always been and remains my constant passion, and whatever I try to communicate really is that passion. I want when a student leaves my class, and 10 years later or 20 years later, when he or she will think of our class, will say, "Ah, I remember the passion." Not the learning, but the passion for learning. Kvai tim la Torah, our masters teach us. We are set aside specific times for study. Discipline is important, if not essential. Don't wait for inspiration, create it. Can one go overboard? In other words, study too much? Of course not. Excess of study is a contradiction in terms. Just as knowledge is bottomless, the road to it is limitless and colorful. In every field of the human quest for meaning, there is always one element that someone else knows better than I. Surely there are scholars in our midst who know more about antiquity than I do. Perhaps our questions will encourage them to share with us their knowledge of the man Josiah and his battles against betrayal and falsehood. All that we know is from the Book of Kings already mentioned. Josiah was a sovereign who did the right thing in the eyes of the Lord. That's what the text says. Others, many others, did not. Generally speaking, in hindsight, everywhere monarchy seems a disappointment. Most regimes were involved in wars, filling cemeteries with young mutilated corpses. Malcolm Muggeridge, the venerable editor, once said of his own magazine, Punch, he said, "Punch isn't what it used to be." And actually, it never was. And that goes for monarchy, too. Forget Nero and his musical aspirations. Forget Caligula and his demented opinions of parliamentary procedures and attendance. Forget Louis IX, who ordered the burning of the Talmud in public squares in Paris. How many sovereigns were involved in the Crusades? King Ferdinand and Queen Isabel of Spain tolerated the Inquisition. The First World War was fought between emperors and kings and tsars. But then why did nations both fear and glorify their monarchs, even tyrants? The French Revolution did not stop the bloodshed, nor did it wipe out monarchy. The bill ordering the execution of Louis XVI was adopted in the French Parliament by a majority of one single vote. Danton, Robespierre, and Marat were all popular figures until each became the victim or executioner of the other. From distant antiquity to the 20th century, history has not been too kind to royalty and the power it personified. In Greek mythology, as well as in Roman politics, few ended their lives peacefully. Most emperors and kings were slain, not by strangers, but by those relatives and former allies. The annals of Islam are also full of similar tales of deceit and horror. Machiavelli was right in declaring, surely with tongue-in-cheek, that poor Septimus Severus, he didn't realize that no tyrant has ever managed to kill his successor. Biblical literature reflects a permanent conflict between royalty and prophecy, or between political power and spiritual power. The prophet was there mainly to prevent the king from becoming an object of idolatry. Didn't the prophet run a similar risk? No. No, prophets were rarely popular. Today in class we spoke about prophecy and we spoke what is the difference between a false prophet and a true prophet. Very simple. The false prophet was there to reassure. The true prophet was there to disturb. Between the prophet and the king, the Talmud rarely hesitates to take a position. More than often, the sympathy of the sages goes to the pacifist prophets rather than to warrior kings, except when the prophet sounds too rigorous, too severe regarding the people, his people, the people of Israel. Then the sages change the tone. What was the prophet's mission if not to shield the people from falling into the traps of idolatry and their kings from succumbing to self-idolatry? And here Josiah emerges as one of the notable exceptions. Numerous texts are here to remind us that already in Scripture, monarchy does not enjoy, say, a good reputation in the Jewish tradition. It is far from being what we might call a success story. God alone is meant to be our king, the king of kings, and all that breathes and exists. Moses, the master of prophets, was not the king of Jews. He was the teacher. Moshe Rabbeinu, our teacher, Moses, the highest compliment we could pay Moses. Nor was Joshua, the commander of the first national liberation army in history, who brought the Jews into the promised land. He was not a king. Saul, as the first Jewish sovereign, he had been a tragic figure, chosen and rejected by God, condemned by Samuel, abandoned by his own military aid, what remains of his kingdom, a melancholy shadow, a sad adventure that ended in suicide. David, the most glorious and admired of kings, the temple was built by his son, not by David. Why? Because David's taste for violence and conquest. David was also criticized for spreading Lashon Hara, gossip, slander about his close entourage. Had David not committed that sin, says the Midrash, his kingdom would have stayed united. His people would not have thrown itself into idol worshipping and then gone into exile. Naturally, David had a troubling episode with a beautiful woman called Bathsheba. Hasn't he sent her husband, the young officer Uri the Hittite, to his death, carrying, by the way, his death sentence into a sealed envelope, only because David wanted to marry his widow? But we say, David Melech Israel Chai V'Kayam. David is Chai, he lives in our memory. Better yet, the Talmud declares that before David, all men in Israel were worthy of the royal crown, but not after him. After him, only his descendants deserve that honor. His descendants? Who were they? One of his sons, Absalom, rebelled against him. The other, Adoniyahu, staged an insurrection to seize his throne. The third, Solomon, married an Egyptian princess. Later, King Ahab, Jezebel's husband, Prophet Elijah's fierce adversary and enemy, forgot the Lord and allowed the people to become idol worshippers again. King Herod, he was pitiless with those near him. He spied on them, hunted them down, humiliated them, had them assassinated. Conscious of his non-Davidic origins, he ordered the burning of all genealogical documents, thus hoping to prevent David's rightful heirs from asserting their claims to the throne. But for our subject tonight, we must think of Josiah's grandfather, Menashe. Who was he? What is his place in history? From the same book of the Kings, we learn that he was 12 years old when he ascended the throne of Judah, and he reigned 50 years in Jerusalem. Quote, "And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He erected high places for idol worship, which his father Hizkiyahu or Ezekias had destroyed. He built for them altars in the house of the Lord," said the Lord. "Menashe set up the image of Asherah," which is a kind of idol, "in the house of which God had said to David and to his son Solomon, 'In this house and in Jerusalem, which I chose of all tribes of Israel, I will set my name forever, nor will I again cause Israel's foot to wander from the land which I have given to their fathers.'" And listen, listen well. Menashe burned his own son as an offering to Moloch. King of Judah killed his son, bringing him as an offering. He also maintained good relations with witches and sorcerers. We are told that Menashe seduced his people to do more evil than the Amorites. And God said, "Because Menashe, king of Judah, has committed such abominations, behold, I am bringing upon Jerusalem and Judah such suffering that the ears of everyone who hears about it will tingle." I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish. God speaks, turning it upside down. I will cast off the remnants of my heritage and deliver them into the hands of their enemies, and they shall become spoil and prey for looting to all enemies. Could God's words be harsher? Could the sins he condemns be more condemnable and repugnant? How could David's not so distant and successor fall so quickly to the abyss of degradation? The biblical text goes farther, and its Midrashic commentary is even farther, in describing Menashe's immoral behavior. Was it perhaps simple ignorance? No, he wasn't ignorant. The Talmud tells us that he could offer 52 different interpretations of the book of Leviticus, so much so that Rav Ashi, the great compiler of the Babylonian Talmud, once announced the next day's lesson to his students with these words, "Tomorrow I shall speak about our colleague Menashe." So what went wrong? It is possible that he possessed knowledge but misused it. Often with scandalous arrogance he would display just to ridicule the Torah's lessons in public. No wonder that he erased God's name from all holy scriptures. Worse, he shed much blood, innocent blood, which filled Jerusalem from one end to another. More, he replaced the altar in the sanctuary with an idol with four faces, copied from the four figures on the throne of God. Thus, from whatever direction one entered the temple, one has confronted an idol. And he is said to have produced an idol so gigantic that it required 1,000 men to carry. Their task lasted one day only, because at sunset they were killed and replaced by a new task force. This was a king of Judah. But one may wonder, granted the Talmud likes exaggerations, but how could a king of Judah go on committing such sins and many crimes with impunity? Were there no prophets around to restrain his evil instincts? Yes, there were. Isaiah was alive and active. But the king persecuted him, accusing him of blasphemy for describing his vision of a celestial chariot. Corrupting the judicial system in the land, Menashe the king had him indicted, judged, and sentenced to death. According to legend, the prophet uttered the holy name, and an immense cedar appeared and gave him shelter by swallowing him up. Undaunted, the king had a saw brought to him, and he himself began slicing through the tree, and that's how he killed the prophet Isaiah. Was he the last evil king in Judah? No, his son Amon, who succeeded the throne at 22, followed for 2 years in his father's footsteps. He declared his intention to outdo him in transgressions by indulging in incest. Disappointing stories of a nation's semi-secular leaders led astray by their inherited, acquired, or usurped power. Oh, yes. As in so many other national histories, ancient Jewish monarchy was also subjected to politically pseudo-religious rivalries in royal palaces, resulting in jealousies, slander, stupid plots and counterplots against the authority, resorting to deceit, violence, and bloodshed to conquer positions of leadership. But weren't the kings elevated by God and anointed by his priests? How could they respond and appeal to what was cruelest and ugliest in those serving them? Does power, excessive power, or thirst for power corrupt everybody, everywhere? Even direct descendants of David, the forefather of the ultimate Redeemer, the Messiah, who is known not as Mashiach Emet, the true Messiah, but as Mashiach Tzidkenu, the just Messiah, whose redemption will mean justice for all. So, of course, the question is, why are our kings evil and embarrassing inclinations and reprehensible deeds that originated in idolatry told with amazing emphasis on detail in the sacred writings and chronicles of our people. Why should we remember them? Only to get depressed? Or to show the dangers of covering up unpleasant aspects of historical figures? To illustrate the perils inherent in absolute power when it is dissociated from God's law? Or to tell us when a king demands total obedience, he in fact turns himself into an idol to be worshipped? Or was it to teach us bitter yet vital lessons about human nature, namely that Jewish leaders, whether political or spiritual, were human with their own shortcomings and weaknesses? That if Abraham and Moses could make mistakes, why would others be spared? Perfection belongs to God alone. His creatures are not, cannot be perfect. Maimonides goes as far as claiming that one must not even aspire to become perfect, because it would imply a measure of arrogant ambitions on our part. But still, here and there, we do come across a special royal personage whom we like. Josiah. So who was he? As we said, he was 8 years old when he began his reign, which lasted 31 years in Jerusalem. His virtues? He did not build sumptuous palaces, nor did he raise invincible armies. The text says of him simply, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He did not turn aside to the right or to the left from David's ways. He collected funds to repair the temple and gave them to the carpenters, to the masons, and to the builders, who were lucky, for no accounting was asked from them, says the text. He trusted their honesty. The text offers concrete elements about King Josiah and his entourage. The name of his secretary, Shaphan, son of Azaliah. The identity of the high priest, Hilkiah, who found the book of the law that had been lost for years and years. And that moment becomes a turning point, a watershed. The scene is described in the text almost in color, full of drama and emotion. The high priest hands the book over to the secretary, who brings it to the king, who rends his clothes in sorrow and remorse, turning to the high officials present, saying, "Go inquire of the Lord for me and for the people, and for all Judah, concerning the words in this book that had been found. For great is the wrath of the Lord, for our fathers have not obeyed the words of this book." And what follows must have been foreseen. The emissaries obeyed. They left the palace immediately. But where did they go? They went to see a woman, one of the seven women prophets mentioned in scripture, being endowed with special powers. The wife of Shallum, who was the wardrobe keeper in the palace, known for his piety. He would roam the streets of Jerusalem and offer water to thirsty pilgrims. And the name of the prophetess is Huldah. It was up to her to draw the proper lesson from the historical event. Her judgment was harsh, rigorous, uncompromising and pitiless. But wait a moment. Why did the royal emissaries go to see her, rather than her contemporaries, Jeremiah or Zephaniah? Has God sent them to her specifically by name? If so, why isn't it in the text? Had the king indicated his preference in secret by a hint? Was it perhaps the emissaries' decision to seek her out because she lived close by in Jerusalem, whereas the others were busy elsewhere? One Midrashic source maintains that Jeremiah was away, trying to find and bring back the 10 lost tribes, so he wasn't there. Was Huldah the only moral compass available? Was hers the only voice of truth? A Midrashic commentator suggests that it was King Josiah himself who chose Huldah, hoping that as a woman she would be more compassionate towards her king and her people. Whatever the answer, Huldah knew her part in the story. If Josiah had hoped to gain her goodwill with flattery, he lived to regret it. Listen to the prophetess. I quote, "Thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, tell the man," not the king, not the man, just the man, "tell the man who sent you to me, behold, I will bring evil and malediction upon this place and upon its inhabitants, because they have forsaken me and have burned incense to other gods. My wrath will be kindled against this land, and it will not be attenuated." One can imagine the impact of her fiery words on the visitors, as they were anticipating what was to follow. More predictions of punishment and disaster, not a single verse of consolation? Yes. The prophetess did have a message of comfort. Surprisingly, it was meant not for the people, for the king. I quote again. "Tell the king of Judah," again, no longer the man, but the king, "tell him who sent you, tell him, because your heart was penitent and you humbled yourself before the Lord and wept before me, I heard you. I will gather you to your fathers. You shall die in peace. Your eyes shall not see the affliction I shall bring upon this place." What a strange message of consolation. Its meaning? The future looked somber for the people, but bright for the king. He's only going to die. The people will suffer, but the king will not be around to witness their distress. But what if the people repented? Wouldn't they be entitled to forgiveness? For in the end, both the king and the people learned the lesson. He repented and made them repent. And the Holy Scripture regained its extolled position in Jerusalem. All idol worship was prohibited. All the altars, monuments, and high places honoring alien gods destroyed. Furthermore, the penitent king ordered the entire nation, men, women, and children, to observe all the laws related to Passover. And as a reward, Josiah was to be remembered as the only Jewish king, with the exception of Solomon, to rule over both Judah and Israel. Was he happier in his later years? Some sources claim that his pedagogical efforts were not entirely successful. Many, if not most, inhabitants did not follow his example. They continued to worship idols, but clandestinely. As for Josiah, Huldah's prophecy was fulfilled. He was the last king of Judah to be buried with his ancestors. But he did not die in his bed. This is what happened. King Pharaoh of Egypt wanted to lead his army through Judah so as to fight the Assyrians. He needed Josiah's permission, and there must have been diplomatic negotiations. Josiah hesitated. He knew what foreign troops in transit could do to civilian populations. He turned to Jeremiah for advice, for which he was criticized. Quoting his teacher Isaiah, who quoted a biblical verse, Jeremiah said, "Let them come in, and they will live in peace." But Josiah quoted the teacher of teachers, Moses, who used more or less the same words, but in a different way. Moses said, "I will give peace in the land, and no sword shall go through it." In other words, no enemy sword should ever go through Judah. In the war between the two empires, Egypt and Assyria, Josiah was hit by 300 arrows, piercing his body into a sieve. Josiah, a victim of an accident, a war hero fallen in battle, his name was recorded with praise and admiration. Why? Because restoring the role of memory and faith in everyday life, he tirelessly fought against idolatry in all its form. So earlier tonight, we raised some serious questions about idolatry, its role. What does it mean? And why is idolatry so seriously condemned in all our Holy Scriptures? How is one to comprehend the attraction idolatry had held with amazing, if not irresistible, force on a people chosen by God to transmit his message to the world at large? What promise, what grandeur was there in paganism that made Judah's inhabitants blind and deaf and indifferent to the eloquent and terrifying warnings of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, only to worship man-made objects of wood or stone? How could the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Moses, and Joshua feel more fervor, more inspiration by a tree or an altar or a piece of wood more than by the idea of a unique God, creator of the universe? How did they manage to forget God's first commandment given at Sinai? I am your God. I took you out of Egyptian bondage, and you shall have no other God. And all the subsequent warnings, the harshest of all, against making graven images. How could Jewish families flee from their faith in God only to fall into primitive, occult, pagan practices? Was it perhaps the everlasting fallout of the sad episode of the golden calf? If Jews could worship a golden animal in the time of Moses, why wouldn't they do the same under Menashe and Josiah? Already in the wilderness, the children of Israel allowed themselves to be seduced by what appeared to be easy, immediate, and concrete answers to all questions. Since God was invisible and Moses absent, why not turn to what the eye can see and the hand feel and do away with fear and anguish? The golden calf episode is one of the saddest and most poignant illustrations of a community's unhealthy addiction to idolatry. Its timing, when it seems to have puzzled various sages, the timing when it happened. They try to determine not only why, but also when it happened. The consensus quoted by Rashi is 40 days after Moses ascended into heaven to receive the law. And as he was a few hours late in returning, Satan used mass witchcraft and showed a man on a deathbed hanging in the air. And the crowd below reacted with despair. What would they do without their leader? That's when they reverted to idolatry. However, Rabbi Meir, Bruria's husband, disagrees. Fully cognizant of man's capacity of ambivalence and ambiguity, he offers a hypothesis which is both courageous and imaginative. He suggests that while still at Sinai, at a very dazzling, meta-historical moment, they accepted the law in an unprecedented outburst, crying out to God, Naseh v'nishma, we shall obey your commandments with every fiber of our being, thus sealing the covenant between God and Israel and Jewish history. Then, right then and there, they already entertained the thought of producing a golden idol. This is what Rabbi Meir says. Why? Simply because people are human and weak. They had just left Egypt and could not discard pagan temptations and uproot their hold on them so fast. All right. That may explain the reoccurring obsession with idols at Sinai. When most liberated slaves with offensive habits still remembered from Egypt's culture were still alive. But about subsequent generations, those who took part in the conquest of the land, in the building of the temple, in the victories of Amalekites and Philistines, those were proudly admired military triumphs. What about the judges, the exhortations of the prophets? Those who had already been aware of Israel's moral tradition, how could they on every level of society relapse into pagan attractions? Had they forgotten that to deny God's uniqueness is to deny God? Let's evoke Maimonides, the 12th century master philosopher, codifier, and interpreter of the Jewish law, what he says about idolatry, and I quote him. It is the duty of Jews to proclaim God's message of faith to the world, undeterred by fear of injury from any source. Should a tyrant try to force us to deny him, we must disobey and rather submit to death. And we must not even mislead a tyrant to believing that we have denied him, while in our hearts we continue to have faith in him. Maimonides also explains why idolatry